The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What prompted you to explore the concept of human evil with this book?
The most dangerous people I've known, I think, never come to the attention of the law because they're intelligent and they're devious. They're manipulative by nature. I knew one in particular, a horrible man directly out of the abyss. And as I walked away from the experience, I thought there's some way I could explain this man. I could explain his nature, the horrible crimes that he committed. And I realized I could not. We cannot explain them through environmental origins. We cannot find raison d'etre for their deeds because of genetic factors, nor can we say that it's behavioral in nature. Psychologists don't deal with them. Every psychologist, every psychiatrist will say, these are people whose secrets you will never learn. That's what makes them disturbing. It's as though they have origins that are other than human ones.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. James Lee Burke is here, and we're talking about his latest crime novel, Light of the World. Light of the World is your 20th Dave Robichaux,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's well known to your faithful readers, but let's just give a short biography of Dave for people who might not be familiar with him.
Well, Dave Robichaux narrates these books from the perspective of a police officer in New Iberia, Louisiana. He's a kind of blue-collar nighty rant, but a deeply flawed man. But I based him on the everyman character in the medieval morality and miracle plays. He ultimately gives voice to those who have none. He has a great sense of empathy for the oppressed and those who often have no advocate.
And in this particular novel, Dave and his family are vacationing in Montana, which mm-hmm. we'll come back to in a minute. But let's hear you read a little bit. At the very beginning of the book, the narrator, Dave Robichaux, is pondering the concept of evil.
All right. This book is titled Light of the World, and this is the opening line and introductory note by the narrator, Dave Robichaux. I was never good at solving mysteries. I don't mean the kind cops solve or the ones you read about in novels or watch on television or on a movie screen. I'm not talking about the mystery of creation either, or the unseen presences that reside perhaps just the other side of the physical world. I'm talking about evil without capitalization, but evil all the same. The kind whose origins sociologists and psychiatrists have trouble explaining. Police officers keep secrets, not unlike soldiers who return from foreign battlefields with the syndrome that survivors of the Great War called the thousand-yard stare. I believe that the account of the apple taken from the forbidden tree is a metaphorical warning about looking too deeply into the darker potential of the human soul. The photographs of the inmates at Bergen-Belsen or Andersonville Prison or the bodies in the ditch at My Lai disturb us in a singular fashion because those instances of egregious human cruelty were committed for the most part by baptized Christians. At some point, we close the book containing photographs of this kind and put it away and convince ourselves that the events were an aberration. The consequence of leaving soldiers too long in the field or letting a handful of misanthropes take control of a bureaucracy. It is not in our interest to extrapolate a larger meaning. Hitler, Nero, Ted Bundy, the bitch of Buchenwald, their deeds are not ours. But if these individuals are not like us, if they do not descend from the same gene pool and have the same DNA, then who were they and what turned them into monsters? Every homicide cop lives with images he cannot rinse from his dreams. Every cop who has handled investigations into child abuse has seen a side of his fellow man he never discusses with anyone, not his wife, not his colleagues, not his confessor or his bartender. There are certain burdens you do not visit on people of goodwill. When I was in plain clothes at the NOPD, I used to deal with problems such as these in a saloon on Magazine Street, not far from the old Irish Channel. With its brass rail bar and felt-covered bourrée tables and wood-bladed fans, it became my secular church where the Louisiana of my youth, the green, gold, mossy, oak-shaded world of Bayou Teche, was only one drink away. I would start with four fingers of Jack in a thick mug with the sweating Budweiser back, and by midnight I would be alone at the end of the bar, armed, drunk, and hunched over my glass, morally and psychologically insane. I had come to feel loathing and disgust with the mythology that characterized the era in which I lived. I didn't serve in Southeast Asia. I survived and watched innocent people and better men than I die in large numbers while I was spared by a hand outside myself. I didn't serve and protect as a police officer. I witnessed the justice system's dysfunction and the government's empowerment of corporations and the exploitation of those who had no political voice. And while I brooded on all that was wrong in the world, I continued to stoke the furnace inside me with Black Jack and Smirnoff's and five-star Hennessy, and finally two jiggers of scotch inside a glass of milk at sunrise, constantly suppressing my desire to lock down on my enemies with the .45 automatic I had purchased in Saigon's brothel district and with which I slept as I would a woman. My real problem wasn't the militarization of my country or any of the other problems I've mentioned. The real problem went back to a mystery that had beset me since the destruction of my natal home and family. My father, Big Al Du, was on the monkey board of an offshore drilling well when the drill bit punched into an early pay sand, and a spark jumped off the wellhead, and a mushroom of flaming oil and natural gas rose through the rigging like an inferno ballooning from the bottom of an elevator shaft. My mother, Allifair May Gilray, was seduced and blackmailed by a gambler and pimp named Mac, whom I hated more than any human being I ever knew, not because he turned her into a barroom whore, but because of the Asian men I killed in his stead. Rage and bloodlust and alcoholic blackouts became the only form of serenity I knew. From Saigon to the Philippines, from Chinatown and Los Angeles to the drunk tanks of New Orleans, the same question haunted me and gave me no rest. Were some people made different in the womb, born without a conscience, intent on destroying everything that was good in the world? Or could a black wind blow the weather vane in the wrong direction for any of us and reshape our lives and turn us into people we no longer recognized? I knew there was an answer out there someplace if I could only drink myself into the right frame of mind and find it. I stayed 90 proof for many years and got a bachelor's degree in self-immolation and a doctorate in chemically induced psychosis. When I finally entered sobriety, I thought the veil might be lifted and I would find answers to all the Byzantine riddles that had confounded me. That was not to be the case. Instead, a man who was one of the most wicked creatures on earth made his way into our lives. This is a tale that maybe I shouldn't share, but it's not one I want to keep inside me either.
Dave, his wife Molly, their adopted daughter Alifair, Cleet Purcell, and now his daughter that he's recently reunited with, Gretchen, have all come to Montana for a vacation. But again, that vacation just doesn't happen.
Well, the past wins its way into their life. And with Dave, the story is ongoing. He believes that the issues of our time have really to do with the survival of both the planet and the human family. And so that question, our survival, is a ubiquitous one. And in this book, we meet some of the players, a fellow from the petrochemical empire by the name of Love Younger, who's a great character from a place called Snaky Holler, Kentucky, which is a real place. I used to live on the ridge right above Snaky Holler. And he's a man who came from very humble origins, and he's the 10th wealthiest man in the United States and has a summer home in Missoula. But we discover that the iniquity he represents, driven by greed and imperious behavior, in many ways is as dangerous or more dangerous than the evil presented to us by this fellow named Asa Surrett, a serial killer who was broken out of a prison van in Kansas and has come to Montana to square a grudge against Alifair Robichaux, Dave's daughter.
Yes, Alifair had interviewed him when he was in prison and written some articles that he didn't like the content of. So
that's
now
right.
He's coming to get her.
That's it.
And finds the whole family in Montana entangled with Love Younger and his family. One of the things that I really noticed that I thought was a powerful concept about Asa Surrett was when Alifair was interviewing him in prison, and she asked him how he felt after he'd killed his victims, and he replied, quote, "I thought about how I had stopped time and changed all the events that would have happened." Mm-hmm. That's really a powerful concept.
Yeah. I guess if there's any abiding characteristic in sociopaths or psychopaths, it's narcissism, where they have messianic feelings about themselves, of course, but they believe they are alterers of history. And here in Montana, there was a murderer, a guy who's executed, it's been about 10, maybe 15 years back. He killed a family up on the Blackfoot River. In the day of his execution, he slept all day. He killed or participated in the killing of five people in the prison while he was on death row. There was a riot at Deer Lodge, and a number of people were killed. And he was killing people there inside the prison. He was 21 years old. The day of his death, he was asked by a reporter, I think from Missoula, "What do you think is going to happen after you're executed, Terry?" And he said, "I will just move on to another plane of existence."
And take his evil with him.
Who knows?
That's a frightening thought.
Yeah. What produced this kid? What's just beyond comprehension? Everyone knows hard luck stories. People who come out of terrible homes, they're abused at children, molested. I mean, you name it, it happened to them. And they bear their burden, they straighten out their lives. And others who seem to have had minimal negative influences, like Bundy, turn out to be truly horrific human beings. But again, Dave Robichaux and the other narrators of my first-person novels all indicate this takes the argument, the problem, out into the wings of the drama. And we focus on people who are clearly morally insane without ever looking at those in our midst who just have the same kind of pathological signs in their behavior. It seems to be in their DNA. but we look upon them as moral, as upright, as people who made wrong political judgments. If you meet them, you discover they never lose a night's sleep over anything. They're responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people.
You're listening to James Lee Burke talk about his latest mystery novel, Light of the World. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. We'll continue our conversation right after a short break. Don't go away. A phrase I remember from our last conversation is what you call the ethos of the American cowboy. So in this particular book, Light of the World, does Wyatt Dixon represent that idea?
Oh, yeah. Wyatt's one of my favorite characters. He's a great guy. I love Wyatt Dixon. But the ethos of the American cowboy is that of the classic existentialistic hero, has all the same characteristics. I remember something Willie Nelson said, and that no one remembers, when he was speaking about a former president. He said, "Stop calling this man a cowboy and saying that he is from Texas. He is not a cowboy. He is not from Texas. So stop trashing Texas and stop trashing cowboys." I said, "Go, Willie." It took Willie to set the record straight. But the point is, if you look at American films, American theater is the American cathedral, ultimately. For some reason, politicians love to denigrate Hollywood, even though we elect actors to public office all the time. I mean, you start with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ronald Reagan, you go right down the list, Sonny Bono. But the truth is that American films reflect the American psyche. And A.B. Guthrie wrote arguably the greatest Western film script ever written, the adaptation of the novel Shane. But here's the existentialist outsider. He has no last name. He appears out of nowhere. And he comes into an Edenic paradise and discovers that, in effect, a serpent, a kind of corporate entity, has taken control over the land. And Shane takes on these evil forces and then eventually disappears into anonymity again. It's an incredible piece of script writing. That last scene when the little boy, played by Brandon Dowhile, is yelling, "Shane, Shane," and Shane disappears into this purple haze in the distance. What a film. And of course, A.B. Guthrie was our friend up there in Shoto. He was really a fine man. He was the first person I met when I came to Montana. We'd only been here a few hours, and we had moved our things into the faculty housing here. It's 1966. And I walked down to the tennis court, and he was there. And he said, "Would you like to play?" And we began hitting the ball, and he says, "My name's Bud Guthrie."
Well, you've tackled a lot of complex issues in this book. Racism, including black, white, Indian, religious fanaticism, sexual violence, environmental destruction, the 1% versus the 99%, and what you write as the sick culture of law enforcement. And, you know, it's a 550-page book, even though it doesn't seem that long when you're reading it, but that's still a lot to take on in one book.
It is. It was, the manuscript was 930 pages. It's the longest book I've written. But
You just had a lot to say about all those issues.
Well, I hope I covered some of them in a way that's partially adequate, but no one ever uses up the subject matter. There's no way to use it up. We were talking earlier that a lot of being a writer requires an ability to listen and to see the drama that takes place around us all the time. That's it. The dialogue is in the air all the time. It's like music. It's a matter of just hearing it or seeing meaning in ordinary events. It's like, this has been my experience, it's like witnessing courage in people, extreme bravery during times of duress. It occurs in people from whom we never expect it. They're 90 pounds soaking wet. They're so nondescript, you forget what they look like 5 minutes after they walk out of a room. And they do incredible things. They throw all awareness of themselves over the gunwales, and they pull people out of burning buildings and just disappear. And they don't want to be bothered. And they say, they're uncomfortable. Anyone would have done it. Leave me alone.
So they're not necessarily the big cowboy character in
the
movie.
That's it.
Well, one of the conundrums that arises in this story, it involves Gretchen, which I mentioned is Cleet Purcell's daughter. She's been sexually assaulted by a law enforcement official, but she doesn't report it. So explain why.
Well, she's going to get even. She's going to square it herself. And number two, she knows how victims of sexual assaults are often treated. They're put on trial. That's not hyperbole. That's what's going to happen. They are always put on trial. The defense always ascribes the problem to the victim.
A little bit about Gretchen. She is Cleet Purcell's daughter, but he didn't know she was his daughter for a while, or he wasn't involved in her earlier life.
No, he didn't know that he had a child out of wedlock until his daughter was in her late teens or mid-teens. And he tried to help her, and then she disappeared from foster care before he could get the custodial process completed. But he tries to do the right thing by her. Cleet is a great character, and of course, he's eccentric. He's larger than life. He's the trickster in folk mythology. And as Dave Robichaux says, his mantra is chaos and mayhem that he spreads across southern Louisiana. And he's like a steel wrecking ball swinging through a stucco house. But he's a good man, and he always errs on the side of charity and honor.
I found it really, fascinating now that you're bringing in these young women into the story. Yeah. So Dave and Cleet are getting older, and now we have Allifair and Gretchen who are starting to be major players in these stories. Is that a trend you intend to continue?
Well, yeah, this book has very strong female central characters in it, and not only the daughters of Dave Robichaux and Cleet Purcell, but we meet Felicity Louvier, who seems to be a Jezebel, a profligate opportunist. But the book is unusual in that it goes back into the 3rd century of the Roman Empire and the martyrdom of Saint Felicity and Saint Perpetua. And this was my attempt to continue the theme of what I see as one of redemption in people who are thought to be lost or who have seemed to embarked upon a life of self-destruction. But it was also my attempt to show the importance of women in the early Christian church, because that's forgotten. There would be no Christian church, Catholic church, any church, had it not been for women. But they've been pushed to the back of the bus. And to me, what's always just dumbfounding is how that has occurred, how that has been allowed to happen. But, you know, if you in the Bible, the biblical, everything written in the New Testament was written for a reason. I don't mean it. I'm not talking about a divine hand. The guys who wrote it knew what it meant. in the story about Jesus' crucifixion. Only three went to the cross. Two were women. The third was a 17-year-old disciple, you know, John the Apostle. But everybody else begged down the road. The guys who wrote that knew what that meant, said, forget the guys. It's like Black Panthers used to say, if you want to start a revolution, stand outside a jail and sign up every guy coming out. That's where you find your membership. The same thing. Look, Dave Robichaux asked a great rhetorical question. In a back alley beer glass brawl, who would you rather you have covering your back, an academic liberal or a hobnailed redneck? That many revolutions, radical movements were led by women. We forget mm-hmm. that.
Every time I talk with you, I have this idea that if we were able to take your head and empty it out of all of its facts, it would fill up room after room after room.
Well, that's very nice of you. Unfortunately, much of what's in my head is of no interest to anyone else.
It makes good stories, though. Oh, well, what else do you want to say about the book?
Go buy it. No, it's one of my best books, I think.
Well, a lot of reviewers said that.
Yeah, it's done quite well. It was number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah.
It's done really well.
What are you working on now?
Book called Wayfaring Strangers. Starts in 1934 with Bonnie and Clyde. It's based on the Holland family. I don't change the names. That's my mother's family, the Hollands. And my great-grandfather was a gunfighter. He was a Baptist preacher, a drunkard, and a gunfighter. He killed 9 men in gun duels. And he became a preacher later, and he got sober, and he hung up his guns. Well, he never quite hung up his guns. They always said when Sam Morgan Holland preached a sermon, everyone was quite attentive. He belonged to the New Hebron Baptist Church in Yoakum, Texas. But the Hollands are really interesting people. And this story deals with not only Bonnie and Clyde, but the Battle of the Ardennes during the Bulge and the beginnings of oil exploration in the Gulf of Mexico. It's quite a book. The oil boom in Texas and some great people that I knew years ago. Bugsy Siegel's in it. Benny Siegel was in Houston, 1947. He stayed at the Shamrock Hotel.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
James Lee Burke lives near Missoula, Montana. You can get more information about him and his books at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, Monday poems, book reviews, and links to our podcast and Facebook page. Hey, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Sheree Newman, wishing you a stack of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Sheree Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.